Catholic Answers Live. Happy Friday to you. I am not Cy Kellett. I am Christopher Check, president of Catholic Answers, sitting in for Cy Kellett, who is a little under the weather. And we ask for your prayers for Cy. I'm sure he's going to be fine, but praying for him is going to help nonetheless. We believe in the power of prayer here at Catholic Answers. In fact, if you donated to our radio drive, that I think that's why Cy is exhausted, because he poured his heart into our radio drive over the past 3 days. If you donated to our radio drive, then you received by Father Hugh Barber an excellent little talk called How to Pray, or Prayer 101, something like that. If you did not donate to our radio drive, it's not too late. CatholicAnswersRadio.com. We're still rounding up a few dollars, and then you can get that excellent talk, no matter how much you give, by Father Hugh Barber. Coming up in our second hour, we have with Jimmy Akin, or in this case, Mr. Akin, because it's a kid show. And so if you know a kid or you are one, get ready to ask your question, because we will only be taking calls from kids in the second hour. And Nick Chamberlain, what defines a kid? How old is a kid by Catholic Answers rules?
I think about 18 and under.
18 and under?
Or 16 and under.
Well, when we apply the sort of the millennial bar, it could be like as high as 25 or 26 and under or something
nowadays,
like that.
Nowadays, yeah.
I know. Now I just defended our millennial audience. All right. So in the second hour, Jimmy Akin, kids show. But in this first hour, we are blessed to have here in studio a dear friend of Catholic Answers and a dear friend of our chaplain, Father Hugh Barber, Father Clemens Galban. Did I get that? Am I close, Father?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Father Clemens is a canon regular of St. Augustine, and he is with a monastery outside of Vienna called Cloister Neuburg. How did I do there? Oh, Father Hugh Barber is with us also, so I should introduce you so you can start correcting my Viennese.
Oh, okay.
Cloister Neuburg, am I close?
Yeah, that was fine.
So on our cruise that we took a couple of summers ago to the Danube, and we stopped in Vienna, we were blessed to have a tour of this magnificent abbey that Father Clemens gave us. It's just outside of Vienna, just east, south?
North and
north.
West.
Oh, that north was going to be my next guess. But it's in that path that John Sobieski would have traveled as he was coming in to relieve the siege in 1683 for Holy Name of Mary. But we were very blessed to have an excellent tour. Father Clemens actually is not Viennese or Austrian by birth. He is of Cuban and New York City descent. Did I get it? Am I close? Did I get it there?
Father? Generally, yeah.
Right, yeah. So Father's actually an American, and was ordained in Washington, D.C., right? Is that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, but has found his way to the canons regular, where he is now permanently stationed there in Vienna. So we thought, since he was here visiting our friend Father Hugh Barber, who's also mm-hmm. with us in studio today. Father Hugh, how are you?
Just great. Glory. Thank you.
It would be great to do a show, a panel show, though we are welcoming callers, on the church in Europe. Because Father, who lives in Europe and is a member of the church, has special insights into this theme. So we're very blessed to have you, Father, and welcome
Thank
to
you.
Southern California and welcome to San Diego. And on this special feast of a patron of Southern California, one of Southern California's patrons, Saint Immedius.
Immedius, patron against earthquakes.
Right. And
And
he's been on the calendar since...
Well, he's been on our local calendar for about 150 to 200 years.
Who?
He's a patron saint, a bishop and martyr, patron saint against earthquakes in Italy and also here. So there you are.
And
he's a very timely patron.
He's been very busy lately.
Yeah. He's a third century martyr.
And we've been having a lot of martyrs in the calendar lately, and we've got another one tomorrow. St. Lawrence.
St. Lawrence, that great martyr. Yeah, it's a feast day even.
And the other day, Father Hugh Barber, you were talking at Mass in one of your sermons on what you like to call liturgical astrology, about the convergence of a number of saints this week. Dominic and Lawrence and John Vianney.
Well, what it means by that is much better than astrology, because it's the saints.
Yes, we say that with a smile.
We say it with a smile. So we don't want any callers telling us that we're pushing astrology.
Okay, no, what we mean here is where the stars align, as it were, in the liturgical calendar.
Right, the saints align. Right. And you'll watch sometimes the readings match perfectly the saint, even though the readings are just from the weekday, et cetera, et cetera. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah. So 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH, 888-318-7884. Our topic today is the church in Europe, and we welcome your calls. Father, let's take a whack at the big picture here. When I think of the church in Europe, I guess there's a number of ways that my imagination goes at this question. One, of course, is that the church comes from Europe. Well, it comes from the Holy Land, right? But it grows by virtue of the political structure of the Roman Empire. Grows throughout Europe, in France and in Germany, places that we'll be visiting on our Rhine cruise next June, CatholicAnswersCruise.com. But then brought to in one form or another, brought to the New World in 1492. But the American experience, in the main, of the church is European. Would you gentlemen say that's? Would you priests say that's fair to say?
Certainly, its origins, absolutely. Yeah.
And so I think of that Belloc quote, which I maybe attributed to him, and maybe he never said it, but I think he did. Right, the church is the faith, and the faith, Europe is the faith, and the faith is Europe. Right,
Hilary Belloc's line. Yeah.
Yeah, and then also in Survivals and New Arrivals, Belloc makes this point, especially about France, and we'll maybe talk about France a little bit later. But he talks about France kind of being, he sort of gives the metaphor of a almost like a mountaintop or a hilltop from which the rest of Europe can be observed. And he notes that if you read, and of course he's talking 100 years ago, but if you read a French newspaper or something, you get a sense of the totality of Europe that maybe you wouldn't if you were reading an English or a German newspaper. But nonetheless, there is a kind of a Christian, or was, a totality of Europe that we called and was in fact called Christendom. And yet now it seems really just to be, Father, if you will, correct me if I'm wrong, kind of a cultural phenomenon.
Well,
so there's sort of a cultural Christianity or cultural Catholicism, but can we say that the faith is actively practiced there?
There is a vibrant Christianity in pockets throughout Europe, of course. I mean, it's the lifeblood of the continent in many ways, and you find that lived actively in many places. But, however, there is a general sense in Europe that the church has receded in importance and is in fact actively marginalized, not just by governments, but by social norms. The one thing you don't want to be in many places is a Catholic, because not because you're not allowed to practice your faith, you're certainly allowed to practice your faith, but oh, please don't talk about it. So rude.
Okay, so that would be one of the manifestations of these social norms. It's no longer considered polite discourse, for example, to evangelize or to engage in apologetics. Or
it's kind of embarrassing if your kid goes to church.
That's the way they are. An example of that would be that, you know, the speeches at the D-Day celebrations in Normandy. You know, our president and other American speakers mentioned God repeatedly. You know, and the prayers and the sacrifices, and the meaning of these crosses lined up here. Macron, the president of France, even though he gave a very nice speech, didn't make a single reference to religion or to God or at all, because in their society, it's simply not done. The president doesn't end his speeches with "God bless France" or "God bless us all." He doesn't say anything.
I'm glad, Father Hugh, that you brought up this contrast mm-hmm. between Europe and the United States, because, and tell me if I'm wrong, my sense is that it is valuable for Americans to look at the church in Europe, not simply because that's our patrimony, and so we need to understand who we are, right? But also to give us a sense, it seems to me that the church's experience in Europe is a little further down the Via Dolorosa, if you will, than perhaps it is here in America.
That's certainly true.
Yeah.
In terms of the level of practice and enthusiasm, I would say so.
And yet there is a kind of a variation, Father Clemens, from one country to the next. When we were in on the Danube, of course, we came to Austria. We ended up, after a little bit of a bus ride, in the Czech Republic, which used to be one half of Czechoslovakia. And in the Czech Republic, I don't know what the numbers are, but they're in the single digits in terms of percentages of active participants in the faith. And yet you get into Slovakia, a more agrarian, more rural part of Europe, and there the faith seems to be a little more vibrant.
Yeah, I would say that's true. I mean, where it's in the more rural areas, the faith is more vibrant. The Slovakia, certainly. The further west you go in Austria, you find greater participation in the church on Sundays. Eastern Austria is particularly bad as far as participation is concerned. It's, I think, in Vienna and surroundings, we have about 4% on Sundays, 3-4%. Depending on your parish.
Yeah. When we come back here after our first break, I want to zero down on Vienna, because of course it has a significance in the history of Europe as a crossroads, really, and even still today. Before we go to a break, Father Hugh Barber, I just want to remind all of our listeners that coming up is our conference in September, at the end of September. It's the last weekend in September, 26-29. The theme this year is The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, and we are blessed with a great lineup of speakers, yourself included, but also the whole speaking team from Catholic Answers, and then Bishop Frank Caggiano from Bridgeport, Diocese of Bridgeport, my brother, Father Paul Cech, Monsignor Eugene Morris, who is just a firebrand and a great speaker, and then the great Augustine scholar, Father David McConey. So, and Rod Bennett as well, historian. 26-29 here in San Diego, CatholicAnswersConference.com. I think, Father, that almost all of the hotel rooms are sold. So if you, and here I'm not talking to you because we have a room for you, Father.
Thank you.
But if you're coming from out of town, register, please, quickly, because it is filling up, CatholicAnswersConference.com, less than 2 months away. And also make that hotel reservation. And by the way, it's a bargain. The Hyatt Aventine is a magnificent hotel, and they've given us a real whale of a deal on these rooms. Jimmy Akin will be calling square dancing, all the fun. And you'll get to take your picture with Catholic Answers chaplain, Father Hugh Barber.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
New on EWTN Radio, The Church Alive.
This is St. Monica, who I think is one of those great role models for so many mothers today.
My mother passed on to eternal life 8 years ago on the Feast of St. Monica. And you know, what a powerful example for me, because I know she prayed me back to the church.
The Church Alive with Brian Patrick, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and Father Thomas Petri. Saturday at 7 a.m. and 1 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Truth. Catholic Answers Live. Christopher Cech, president of Catholic Answers, sitting in for the recovering Cy Kellett. Keep Cy in your prayers. With me in studio, our special guest, Father Clemens Galban of the Canons Regular of St. Augustine of Klosterneuburg, northwest of Vienna, and our dear chaplain, Father Hugh Barber. Our topic today, the church in Europe. Father Clemens, when just before we went to break there, I said that I'd like to kind of get your sense, or I'd like for you to give a sense for our listeners about the unique role of Vienna in the history of Christendom, and yet and yet even in sort of this kind of post-Christian era, Vienna nonetheless maintains a significant role in the life of Europe. Am I expressing the question well?
I think I see what you mean. Vienna is the crossroads between East and West, still very much today. Throughout the artwork in our monastery, you find Byzantine depictions of many scenes of the Bible because you had Byzantine artists coming through. We have in our collection the famous Verdun altarpiece, which is done in enamel. In Limoges work, which is the capital of that was Constantinople, and the artist Nicholas of Verdun was on his way back from learning his art in Constantinople when he stopped in Vienna, and they asked him to make this altarpiece, well, what became an altarpiece. So it's very much the crossroads. And even in religion today, you find this mix of... You have a lot of Eastern Orthodox, a lot of... also, of course, we have a large Muslim population in Vienna, and a lot of people coming through. It's still very much the last stop on the Christian train, as it were, before
sure.
Before you get into the Great East, as it were.
Sure, sure. And I want to come back to this question of Europe's experience or Christendom's experience with Islam. But before we do something, and I'd ask for both of you, the priests, to give me your thoughts about this. One of the things that puzzles me about Europe, and I've probably been now a couple dozen times to various places, but I remember as a much younger man going to Prague and being struck by so much over-the-top Baroque magnificence, and yet struck by empty churches. And I thought, how could somebody be so inured to all of this beauty and all this history and all this architectural history, if you will, to walk up and down the Charles Bridge there, for example, and not be aware of these colossal saints that on either side. Now, and maybe there's some naivete in me there, but we have nothing like we have beautiful churches in America, but nothing like the architectural and artistic patrimony to which Father refers. And yet, to me, that would seem to be all that it would take to kind of preserve a life of active practice of the faith among the faithful. And yet, it isn't sufficient, Father Hugh.
Yes, well... It's sort of like hiding in full view.
Right.
Know, people get used to certain things. And, of course, it has a lot to do with the system of education and some long decades of communist rule.
Sure.
And so, you know, where children are formed in that context, if religion has no part to play in their formation and they're not taught to notice things or to value them, then they won't. And also in the Czech Republic, too, you have this immense expulsion of the German population and the replacement by the communists with people that never had lived there before. So to a lot of these people, the old village churches that they, and the villages they now occupied after World War II, were not particularly significant to them because they'd been brought in from other places. So there are a lot of things that would weaken the attachment to faith. But it is amazing. For someone who has an active living Catholic faith, of course, it's...
It's overwhelming.
It's stupendous. You're constantly being reminded of the faith and of the saints and all of that. But I can easily see why it might be possible for someone not to take note of that.
And yet, even
they were raised in an environment that didn't emphasize it.
And yet, even communism doesn't even explain all of it. Father Clemens, you and I were talking about before the show. Countries like Poland, for example, of course, which had its duel with communism, is one of the places where... So how do we explain a lack of faith in the Czech Republic and a vibrancy of faith in a country like Poland?
Well, it's difficult. There are a lot of factors that are involved in that. But, I mean, one thing is clear is that the Polish church was always definitively the spokesperson for the people, the Polish people. Even in the face of an atheistic regime, the solidarity of the church with the common Polish worker, the common Polish man or woman, was absolute. And they were seen by the people as their actual representatives, and that the regime itself was, although governed by Poles, it was an alien regime. So you did not also, so the communist regime had to make deals with the Polish bishops. In the Czech Republic, it was much more brutal. It was one of the most brutal repressions of the faith in Eastern Europe, and they just simply went through it like a hot knife through butter.
Sure, sure. And now, of course, Poland, we look at very much as, you know, an example of vibrancy of the faith as compared to the rest of Europe. They have something of a birth rate there, but to be a Christian in Poland now, or to be a Catholic in Poland, you're coming under a lot of cultural and political fire. Is that fair to say?
I think it's in Poland. I'd say that it's still, it depends what part of Poland too. The north by Warsaw is more secular, certainly, but there's the south is almost, it's just anyone, when you come from anywhere else in Europe and you go to southern Poland, Krakow, for instance, and the diocese in the south, you don't recognize life because the faith is so vigorously practiced. Churches are full all the time. Turn the lights on, they show up. I mean, it's dramatic. The participation of the faithful in southern Poland, and apparently that is not the way everywhere. And of course, there are forces at work which certainly want to knock the church off of its pedestal, shall we say.
So one of these forces, Father Hugh Barber, as you know, I like to listen to the BBC from time to time, and there are I've forgotten the name of them, but there is an overtly Christian political party in Poland right now, right?
Yeah,
I've forgotten what they're called.
There's one large one, and then there's a second smaller one. I can't remember the name.
Right, and both of these come under fire from the broader European media.
Oh yeah, the EU type media,
right.
Certainly.
Right.
They don't like any of this Catholic stuff, you know.
No, not in the least.
My
third son was in Krakow for a few days when he was studying in Rome last semester, John Paul, and he fell in love with the place. He says, I want to move there. But I think it was probably the beer and the sausage. He said sausage and beer is very inexpensive.
Yes, well.
In Krakow.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very inexpensive.
Let's see if we can get a question in here before the break. Can we go to Tim in Denver? Listening on 1060 AM. Tim, welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Thank you. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing great. Glad to have you on the show.
Thanks.
Well, thanks for taking my question. My question is this. How would you compare the church in Europe today to the church in the United States?
Okay. Well, I think you've asked the question for the rest of the hour there.
Yes. Yeah.
Father Clemens?
Well, I think it's very difficult to compare the two, but you have a very vigorous church in the United States still. The church in the United States, of course, has a very different history. It's only a couple of hundred years old, shall we say. And it has found its place in American society. And we also see, as it found its place, that there is a cooling of zeal among its members very often. Europe, you have the church plays a different role in many ways. There is still active faith the way we would understand it, you know, people who really are gung-ho for the faith and want it. But in the broader sense of the society, it's as much a cohesive social force which is not particularly bonded to Jesus Christ and the belief in Jesus Christ. There's a belief in the importance of the church and its role in, say, Austrian society. But I'm glad the church is there as a Catholic in Austria, but I don't really want to go aside from Christmas and Easter and make sure my kid gets baptized and confirmed, hopefully. But, you know, if that doesn't work out, then that doesn't work out. They would still want, though, the church to have a role in some sense, because it's just part of the essential identity so the country.
So there's a kind of a cultural unity or glue, that, a cultural glue that the church influences or brings to bear on daily life in Europe that in one sense really doesn't exist. Like for example, the calendar in Europe will still have, you know, religious festivals on it. I think of, like, for example, St. Joseph's Day in Italy, for example.
Yeah, certain holy days there are civil holidays as well.
Yeah, so there would be sort of a cultural influence in that regard, but the faith as it's actually practiced, the sacramental life, the spiritual life, the evangelization and apologetics, that's something we associate with the United States. All right, we'll be back.
More on this later.
Right after the break.
More on this.
In his new audio presentation, The Very First Fathers, apologist Jimmy Akin takes you on a tour of the earliest Christian writings outside the New Testament. From the most famous figures and most notable works to those lesser known but no less important, this pivotal time in the development of the early church is revealed in fascinating detail. Jimmy shows how, even in the first century after the resurrection, it was necessary to defend and explain truths that are still under attack today, such as the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist and the perpetual virginity of Mary. The Very First Fathers is a compelling look at the dawn of the Christian age and edifying listening for anyone who wants to understand and defend the full truth of Catholicism. Order your copy of The Very First Fathers today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Looking for an on-fire Catholic speaker for your event? Catholic Answers speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew that she wanted those things, that in them somehow she would find God. Over the years as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Dr. David Anders. Do you have questions about the Catholic faith? Listen for the best of Cold to Communion on Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern and live on Monday, 2 p.m. Eastern. Cold to Communion on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. David Anders. Catch him on Call to Communion. 888-318-7884 is the telephone number. 888-318-7884. 888-31-TRUTH. Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers, sitting in for the recovering Cy Kellett here on this feast of St.
Immedius.
Patron saint of earthquake sufferers.
Right, against earthquakes. Right.
Against earthquakes.
It's also the feast of St. Teresa Benedict of the Cross, Edith Stein.
Also known as Edith Stein.
The general calendar, yes. Right. But here in California.
And the vigil or the eve of St. Lawrence, the martyr. And if you're coming with us to Rome, we're going to go to St. Paul outside the walls. No,
St. Lawrence
outside the walls. Thank you, where you can see his grill. Along with Justin Martyr's, I think his relics are in that same church.
I think they are. And Pius the Ninth.
Right. Yeah. Glory to God. Good, good, good. All right. Well, that's a good segue into our topic today, which is the church in Europe. 888-318-7884. Father Clemens, during the break, you were making the point, the question had come up about the contrast between the church in America and the church in Europe. And I think you made a very good point. I'd like you to repeat this for the listeners, about how the church in America, particularly the Catholic Church I speak of here, is sort of a parallel institution, whereas in Europe, it is Europe, as Belloc said.
Well, since you had like the public school system was in its origins in the United States, essentially a Protestant organ, and promoted Protestant religion. And in reaction to that, the Catholic Church produced the famous parochial schools as a parallel institution to raise the children of the immigrant families of Catholic immigrants in the Catholic faith.
There was an occasion in the history of this country where half of Catholic children attended parochial schools. And, I mean, it's extraordinary to think of now.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And, of course, is the second or the third Baltimore Council near the end of the 19th century is outlining the plan for the expansion of Catholic churches, for the building of the institutions, as you were saying, Father, during the break. Build the gymnasium, build the school, have mass in the gymnasium, and then build the church. This was the model. I mean, I'm not saying every church did this, but that was the model for church expansion.
Especially out here.
Right, you know. But in Europe,
we didn't have parochial schools. We don't have parochial schools. You occasionally get private schools run by religious orders. In Austria, we have several very good ones, usually run by Benedictines or one of the other religious orders. The School Sisters of Notre Dame, for instance, various orders. But you don't have this notion of a parochial school. The priest would go for a long time. In fact, it was obligatory for the associate pastors or the vicars of the parishes, the Catholic parishes, to go into the public schools and teach religion there. And that's enshrined in the Concordat, the document stating the relationship between Austria and the Holy See. That's enshrined in the Concordat.
But don't priests still go into the public schools there to teach
religion? They do. We
also
have
in Germany, I think. Also, yeah.
They do. They do. It's with the lack of, with the decline in priestly vocations, of course, you see the rise of the lay religion teachers, which is fine, but it also has placed the priests one step further away from this vital group, which is our young people.
I've always thought that this reality of the church, as you say, a parallel institution in the United States, is one of the reasons an organization like Catholic Answers comes to fruition in the United States, where you tend not to see apologetics or evangelism, especially lay-run apologetics or evangelization organizations in Europe. In fact, when I have conversations with Monsignors in Rome, for example, they always want to know, well, what bishop started Catholic Answers? What priest started it? And I said, no, it was started by my friend Carl Keating, who was an attorney. And so, but in the early days of Catholic Answers, it very much was that parallel reality, in this case, between Catholicism and Protestantism, or American Protestantism especially, that the friction, if you will, or the need or the demand that in which Catholic Answers comes to fruition. Yeah. And that's a unique American thing.
They're catching on, though, in some places, Chris. I have noticed, I mean, in Heiligenkreuz, Stift Heiligenkreuz is a Cistercian abbey south of Vienna. It's only about 45 minutes from my monastery. In fact, it was founded by the same Saint Leopold, and he founded both houses. But they have started a television and radio evangelization in their monastery, connected to also their theological faculty, which they've begun to educate seminarians.
I know there's another place in Europe. A good friend of ours is Bishop Dominique Ray, who is the bishop of my French is
Toulon,
Fréjus-Toulon, which is in the south of France there, and where he's got all the famous beaches, of course, a very heavy Muslim population, in the middle of which he put a Latin Mass parish, but he's trained some of his priests to go into the nightclubs and the beaches and do apologetics and evangelization.
No, he's remarkable in the French episcopate, and he's very well known and regarded for that. He was here about a couple of years ago,
sure,
and they were traveling around the United States looking at different methods of evangelization because, yeah, you know, including
Protestant ones.
Of course, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Rick Warren gave them like 3 or 4 days.
Sure.
To look around and everything. But it's also true that that's linked to the fact that in France, and also I imagine in Germany and other places, the movements that exist that are extra parochial,
right,
are, you know, maintain a certain, you know, vibrant practice the Catholic faith.
One thing that I remember from his visit here, something I will never forget, it absolutely convicted me, and I felt so small. I was having lunch with him and just making small talk, and I said to him, Your Excellency, what is your greatest challenge as a bishop? And he says, every day, my own conversion.
Oh, yeah.
Every day, my own conversion. Let's go back to phones. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Let's go to John in Orlando, Florida, listening on EWTN 130 Sirius XM. John, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks for taking my call.
Hey, did I pronounce your name correctly?
So, yes, you did.
Okay.
It's Giancarlo, but I did Gian for short.
Okay, very good.
I spend every summer since I was 4 years old in Germany, and I had asked, actually it's a two-part question, so forgive me, my grandparents why they never went to church, and my grandfather's answer was, I don't pay the church tax, therefore I'm not going to go or I can't go. And I was wondering if you can elaborate on that a little.
Father, explain the church tax.
The church tax is... a fee levied by, in Germany, it's levied by the state via Concordat. In Austria, it's levied by the church herself, which seems very poor policy, but you didn't hear me say that. It's never good when the church reaches into your pocket directly, is it? It's one thing to ask for...
With the force of law, yeah.
Right. Well, it's not really the force of law. They don't get so far as the force of law. But in Germany, it is collected by the state. Every participating Roman Catholic pays a certain percentage. I forget. I think it's 1% of their income to the church. The history behind it is important and interesting because Napoleon, when he invaded Germany... In the 19th century, he confiscated all of the ecclesiastical properties. Monasteries and hospitals and Catholic institutions that were sustained by properties, farms, you know, whatever it might have been that supported these institutions, which you had. They were all endowed with something so they could survive. And all their work was paid for by these things. They didn't collect money from the faithful. These things were dissolved and handed over to nobility as sort of bribes to accept this change. When they began refounding them 50 years later or so, refounding institutions like monasteries, Catholic hospitals, convents of nuns, how were they to survive? They couldn't have survived because all of their properties had been confiscated and no one was giving them back willingly. They had changed hands in some instances several times. So to support the church, it was stated there will now be a church tax, which will be levied by the state. This is also levied for the Lutherans. Now, in Austria, it's a church fee, technically, and it's, I believe, also enshrined in the Concordat between Vienna and the Vatican.
Also Italy, France.
Right, but it has its in Austria, it has its roots in the Hitlerian regime. Adolf Hitler basically took the fund that existed in Austria, created 200 years earlier. He took the fund that was created for the support of the clergy and the support of the church. There are institutions like the monasteries. For instance, my own monastery does not live from the church fee, nor do many monasteries. They live from their own, the endowed lands which they were given because they were never secularized. But other things, parish priests, for instance, were being paid out of this fund. This fund was taken by Adolf Hitler and then, of course, committed to the war effort. And he said, in its place, I will allow Austria to levy a fee for the faith on the faithful. For many years, that was considered a badge of honor to pay the church fee because you were saying, I'm an Austrian, I'm a Catholic, and to heck with everyone else, and I'm paying. Now, of course, the tide has turned in another direction. Why should I pay 1%, you know, of my income?
But Father Clemens, how would Giancarlo's father, I mean, whether he paid the church tax or not, is that a decision that he makes just not to go?
It's a decision.
Or because they're not going to stop him at the door.
No, it's a decision that someone made.
I see.
And to say either out of financial reasons or out of just simple
loss of interest in the faith.
Loss of interest.
Yeah. Kloster Norberg is supported by all that Gruner Veltliner that you guys sell. Is that right?
We are indeed Austria's oldest and largest private wine producer.
Yeah, good stuff.
However, actually, it does not produce much income, sadly.
Giancarlo, what's your second question?
I appreciate the clarification. So the second question is, when I went to Mass last year, there was, I don't know if it's a way to count that there's enough hosts for people, but there was like two little baskets right before you got to the pews where people would go their separate ways and sit down. And what it appeared to me was it was a basket full of unconsecrated hosts, and they had these like little tweezers. People would pick one up and put it in the other basket that was right next to it and then go sit down. And I had never seen anything like that before. And I was wondering if you could
I've seen this in England as well.
Yeah, it's only to make sure that everyone who wants to go to communion places a host in the other basket so that they know. So they consecrate more or less only hosts for that Mass.
Is there in Europe a practice of not going to communion? Here in America, whether people are in sin or not, they go to communion.
In Europe, there's, at least in the South, people, it's very common that people will not automatically communicate. You know, they still have the sense, at least in the South, that you got to go to confession before going to communion. That's their general. And I would imagine it's true also in Austria.
Generally, you will find some people who have the sensibility. It's usually combined with an enormous resentment. But they do have the sensibility that they shouldn't go. There are some, but by and large, everyone just goes. Yeah.
But I would say in Spain and Italy, you know, people, they obviously go to Mass regularly and on Sunday, but they don't automatically communicate. And that just seems like the survival of a more traditional mindset.
Our hour is flying by very quickly. We have one more break to take. When we come back, I want to talk about what the bright lights are in Europe that we can draw some inspiration and give us some reasons to continue to pray. Before we go to break, Father, I just want to remind all of our listeners again, Catholic Answers Conference is coming up September 26th to 29. CatholicAnswersConference.com. Our theme is The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. So, my friends, all of those things that you see in the church, the sacramental life, confessing your sins to a priest, a sacrifice that represents the sacrifice of Calvary, the
veneration of saints and holy images.
Sure, the primacy of the papacy, the veneration of
celibacy.
The veneration of the Blessed Virgin Mary. All of these things are there from the very beginning, and we're going to make the case for you at the conference, CatholicAnswersConference.com.
This is Dr. Scott Hahn, and stay tuned for more Catholic Answers Live.
St. Augustine gives us tremendous insight as to why we should pray. He says this, "Why God should ask us to pray when He knows what we need even before we ask Him may perplex us if we do not realize that our Lord and God does not want to know what we want, for as God He cannot fail to already know it. But rather He wants us to exercise our desire through our prayers so that we may be able to receive what He is preparing to give us."
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Catholic Answers Live. Chris Check sitting in for Cy Kellett, recovering from our radio drive. CatholicAnswersRadio.com if you still want to donate. with me in studio, Father Clemens Galban of Kloster Neuburg outside of Vienna, and our dear chaplain, Father Hugh Barber. We're talking about the church in Europe. Gentlemen, I don't want to... Is it okay to call priests gentlemen? Fathers.
Yes, it's perfect.
Gentlemen's fine.
Fathers, okay.
Gentlemen, yeah. We are gentlemen.
Just
we
guy. Guy is kind of annoying.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll try not to do that on the air. I don't want to leave our... listeners with any sense of despair, of course. There are a lot of things about the state of the church in Europe. The birth rate, for example, among Christians in Europe is to the point where the demographers say this cannot be reversed, right? But nonetheless, we're Christians, so we have hope. We hope in the supernatural. So I'd like to talk about some of those signs of hope. However, before I do, and actually I think this may lead us to this conversation, I'd like to hear a little bit about Europe's experience with Islam. Not least of which reason I want to is because my sense is that the European experience with Islam, of course, is much older, but in the present age, it's further down the road, you might say, than America's experience with Islam. Is that fair to say?
Certainly. I think the main issue now is that before there was an actual active resistance to what was, you know, a violent relationship with Islam, you know, that had to do with wars and the Crusades, and that they really that was identified with the whole work of Christian society, where now it isn't at all. It's just immigration.
And there's a kind of an accommodation too, right, Father Clemens, would you say? Or
In many ways there are.
By the way, on the part of the church.
Well, I think that there are some who believe that we should all simply, which certainly we should simply coexist. And the hope there is, I guess, that it'd be a peaceful coexistence and that everyone can simply practice his or her own faith as seen fit. Whether or not it actually works out that way is a different matter.
Sure.
Especially because of the birth rate, most of all.
Right.
The population is...
Demography is destiny.
I mean, as parts of Europe could easily become Islamic, you know, already have, if you
sure.
talk about areas of cities.
Well, you have to pay to get into the Hagia Sophia, so why not St. Peter's one day, you know? right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, please no.
Yeah.
But where the tomb of Peter is. But, Father, before the show, you and I were talking about something you perceive as a failure on the part of the church in Europe, which was the failure to create a seminary that would have addressed this cultural challenge or religious challenge.
Well, a seminary or an institution or institutions which would be founded to evangelize the Muslim immigration. And this is something that does not seem to be happening or hasn't happened, and there seems to be precious little interest on the side of the hierarchy to actually do that. The evangelization that does go on is very often on the side of the Muslims or certain Muslim individuals who come, for instance, to Vienna, but because Vienna is the crossroads. We have seen several people from the Middle East come to Vienna in search of catechesis and baptism. They would come on short hops from various countries in the Middle East. You know, they would come to Vienna, seek out a priest, engage him for pre-baptismal studies, and they would keep coming back to Vienna seemingly as tourists, but really seeking catechesis and then baptism.
So there's a demand here that maybe the church is failing to meet.
Well, it's a demand that's on the side of many Muslims who come, say, to Vienna, and many immigrants. But it's culturally very difficult because, of course, in Islam there's a great sense of solidarity with each other, and no one is allowed to break ranks.
Well, we certainly saw an example of this a couple days ago on the show where the caller from Turkey called in expressing concern about his well-being if he were to convert to Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's interesting that we find this among, in your case, Father, in your experience, among Persians or Iranians, and maybe less so among Turks or...
Several Persians. I know of quite a few Persians, actually, who have taken this route through Vienna to seek baptism. They didn't want to move to the West. They just simply wanted to be baptized and become Christians. And so they weren't, in fact, immigrating.
Yeah, good, good, good. Oh. In talking about, and you yourself have even, you've baptized.
Yes.
And, yeah, yeah. So there are signs of hope there. They may not make the front page of the Guardian, but
well, they don't want to be on the front page
or Le Monde.
No.
But I do know in France that particularly where with respect to the traditional liturgy, that that Chartres pilgrimage seems to grow every year, and there is a there's a growth of. Of devotion, like I say, I think especially tied around the traditional liturgy, Father Yu.
Yes, but there are movements that are not traditionalists that are still Orthodox and very popular as
if
well.
If you look at Stift Heiligenkreuz, this monastery, this Cistercian monastery south of Vienna, they have had an explosion of growth in vocations these last years, and for a essentially contemplative monastery. They are doing a tremendous amount of evangelization in social media, also through their, I think they have a connection to EWTN. They've connected themselves and do video work and radio work. And it's really a growing phenomenon. They've recently founded a new monastery in the area of Brandenburg, not so far from Berlin, a couple of hours from Berlin. So they're expanding even.
Yeah, praise God. Let's see if we can get a couple more questions in here. Let's go to Nick in Missouri. Nick, welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
Yeah, so I just got returned from Austria. I went to school at the International Theological Institute near Vienna.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Sure,
we have.
Oh yeah,
we have people in the building who've been there.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay, it's a great place, and I just wanted to share that, like, I made really good friendships with a lot of Europeans, like a lot of people from Europe, and especially in Austria and other countries, Slovakia, Ukraine, where the Europeans are very strong in their faith. And very good example, like someone I can learn from, like a whole lot as an American. And especially in Austria, I know, like there's a Catholic movement, for young people called Loreto,
mm-hmm.
That is doing a lot of evangelization. And yeah, so my experience was pretty hopeful, even, you know, that there are good, and just to mention, like, the focus missionaries from America are also in Europe now in a couple places, in England, Ireland, and in Vienna. So there are, like, movements going on that are very positive.
No, that's true, Nick. Thanks for your call. That is very true. Even in our monastery, we come across the, as we call them, the Movimenti quite often. They are part of the leaven that is trying to really raise the loaf. It's really a wonderful thing. A lot of these, what they're doing. Cardinal Schönborn was instrumental in bringing in a lot of into the Archdiocese of Vienna a lot of these movements, and they definitely form nuclei of faith and zeal in the population. So that is definitely true.
But they've got to start producing a population. It's very important.
They're trying. They're trying. They are trying. They produce children. Yes.
Right. They really got to do that.
It's critical.
It's a fairly urgent problem.
It is, and in Russia as well, right? And
yeah,
in the far eastern end
of
Europe, right? Good, 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 good. Father Hugh, we're going to wrap up here. Any signs of hope that you want to call attention to in Europe, in what was once called Christendom?
I think the fact that that Catholic devotion still, you know, we have Catholics from all over the world in the United States, but all of them, you know, standard, you know, white Americans, Hispanics, Filipinos, different other Asians, they all go to the European shrines. They keep them going, and they want to go there. So.
Yeah, it's like on the Esquiline Hill there, Santa Prassede or Santa Pudenziana, I think it is the Philippine National Church there in Rome.
No. So there's a lot of that. The church is vibrant there also because of the new populations that are coming.
Father Clemens, thank you for being on the show. Father Hugh Barber, thank you. Keep us in your prayers.
Definitely.
Coming up, Jimmy Akin, Catholic Answers Live.